Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're really digging into something fundamental, especially for understanding how our own communities, you know, places like Deer Park, LaPorte, Pasadena, how they came to be.
Yeah, we're talking about the history of housing segregation in the U.S.
Exactly. And not just looking at, well, the outcomes we see today, but the intentional policies behind it all.
Right. Because these patterns we see in cities, they often weren't just accidental. They were, you know, deliberately created over a long time.
And to help us unpack this this complex history, we're looking at a discussion from the Dole Institute of Politics. It features Ed Pinto from AEI and Mark Treskin from the Urban Institute.
Yeah, these guys have decades of experience looking at housing markets, urban policy, really deep expertise.
And one thing that jumped out from their talk, something that really hits home, the intentionality.
Oh, you mean the National Association of Real Estate Boards 1924 Code of Ethics?
Yes. I mean, think about that. Their ethics code basically said, don't introduce people of certain races or nationalities if it might hurt property values.
It's pretty shocking, isn't it? Mm-hmm. It wasn't subtle. It was right there, a core principle for realtors back then.
It really shows how deep that idea of racial separation was embedded in the whole system.
Totally. It wasn't some hidden thing. It was stated policy.
So our goal with this deep dive is to understand that campaigns, cities, states, the federal government, all pushing for segregated housing. How widespread was it? Who did it target?
And importantly, what are the lasting effects? You know, even today in our communities, what are the economic consequences?
Right. And hopefully understanding this can help inform, you know, what we might do locally here in the Deer Park area.
And for everyone listening, we know you want to get the key info without getting totally bogged down. So we'll pull out the important bits, make the connections clear.
Definitely. Okay. So even before that 1924 ethics code, there were attempts at direct racial zoning, right? But the Supreme Court actually stepped in.
Yeah. In 1917, the Supreme Court ruled against those explicit racial zoning laws. Buchanan v. Worley.
Okay, so that door closed, but it didn't stop the effort, did it? What happened next?
Well, that ruling kind of pushed things in a different direction. They had to find other ways, maybe even more effective ways, to achieve segregation.
How so?
A focus shifted away from just explicitly naming race towards using economic tools, land use rules, that sort of thing.
Ah, okay. And this takes us into the 1920s, and the federal government gets involved. Pinto mentioned the Department of Commerce under Herbert Hoover.
Yeah, he called it an extraordinary role. And it's kind of wild because Hoover was seen as a progressive, right?
Right.
But even he apparently saw segregated cities as just, well, the obvious way to organize cities and neighborhoods. That was the thinking then.
Wow. So what did the Commerce Department actually do? Starting around 1921?
Well, they started issuing guidelines, model ordinances really, for municipal zoning. This was after enabling legislation allowed cities to zone.
And what was driving this big federal push into local zoning?
You got to look at the context. The Great Migration was happening, right? Black Americans moving from the South to northern cities starting around 1915 or so.
And that caused concern.
Yeah, you saw language about concern about invasion into these northern cities. And the strategy that emerged was basically economic exclusion.
Make housing too expensive.
Exactly.
Yeah.
If you can't legally bar people based on race, maybe you can price them out. This targeted Black Americans, but initially also Southern and Eastern European immigrants, too.
So how did the zoning guidelines make housing more expensive? What were the specific tactics?
Oh, very specific things. Mandating single-family detached houses only. Requiring side yards, front yards, setting minimum lot sizes, often pretty large ones.
Okay.
Plus requirements for more expensive building materials, other building code stuff.
Oh, yeah.
It all added up, pushed the prices way up.
Built-in exclusivity. It's interesting, though, you mentioned Southern and Eastern European immigrants. They weren't always excluded by this.
Yeah, that's a nuance. Often those groups had a history of, like, small businesses, a really strong drive for homeownership. And they often managed to overcome those cost barriers.
So the impact wasn't always exactly as intended across all groups.
Right. Shows how complex these things can be.
And then there's a big court case, Euclid v. Ohio, around 1926. What did that do?
That was huge. Euclid basically gave the constitutional green light to this kind of exclusionary zoning, you know, banning everything but single-family homes in certain areas.
So it legitimized the whole strategy the Commerce Department was pushing.
Pretty much. It provided the legal foundation for these zoning practices that, well, we still live with today in many ways.
And the experts mentioned how fast this spread after 1921, like wildfire almost.
Yeah, it suggests a really coordinated effort, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Heavily influenced by those Commerce Department model laws and the fact they were tracking who adopted them.
It wasn't just a slow, organic thing. It was quick, seemed synchronized.
A massive shift in urban planning in a pretty short time.
It makes you wonder, here in Deer Park, La Porte, Pasadena, how much do our own local zoning codes still carry echoes of that 1920s model?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? That foundation laid back then, it's had a really long shadow.
Okay, but was it just about racism? Or were there other genuine concerns like, you know, safe buildings, public health?
Well, that's where it gets tricky. The official reasons often sounded okay: health, safety, orderly development.
But
when you look at the documents from the time, you see these code words, these dog whistles, constant talk about protecting property value.
Right. Like that appraiser, McMichaels, his views changed over just a few years.
Exactly. In 23, he's kind of downplaying the race angle in zoning. By 1928, he's explicitly writing that zoning's purpose is to stop the invasion by blacks and by ethnic groups.
Wow, that's a big shift.
It really is. Shows a growing public admission of the real motives.
Hmm.
And it fits perfectly with what the National Association of Real Estate Boards was openly saying.
This wasn't just a side effect. It was baked in.
Absolutely. A key part of building segregated neighborhoods.
They also mentioned Chicago briefly as a kind of poster child for this.
Yeah. Chicago's history with segregation and exclusionary zoning, especially with the Great Migration, is really stark. And then you have the whole issue of metro areas breaking up into tons of little municipalities.
Each doing its own exclusionary zoning.
Right, creating this complex patchwork that just locked segregation in even tighter across the whole region.
Okay, so let's shift to the 1930s, the New Deal. We get agencies like the Homeowners Loan Corporation, the HOLC, and the Federal Housing Administration, the FHA. Their goal seemed positive, right? Helping people own homes.
On the surface, yes. Stabilize the market during the Depression, boost homeownership. Sounds good.
But the methods?
The methods had huge discriminatory impacts. Yeah. The HOLC, for instance, created those infamous redlining maps.
Literally drawing red lines around certain neighborhoods.
Yeah. In over 100 cities, neighborhoods with black populations, immigrant populations, that were colored red, labeled hazardous for lending.
So no mortgages, no investment in those areas.
Pretty much. It institutionalized disinvestment and really entrenched segregation. Cut those communities off.
And there was mention of other policies, like the Davis-Bacon Act, maybe having racial motivations, too.
Yeah, the idea that it might have been used to keep lower-wage, often black-owned construction firms from getting federal contracts, it shows how bias could seep into different areas of policy.
But the FHA, that seems like the really big player long-term. They took over from the Commerce Department's role.
In many ways, yes. And critically, the FHA didn't just accept the existing segregationist zoning. They built it into their own rules for insuring mortgages.
So they weren't just neutral. They actively promoted it.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Their underwriting manuals, I mean, it wasn't the whole manual, but parts explicitly warned against the mixing of races and ethnic groups, tied it directly to property values again.
Wow. They actually put that in writing.
They did. And they had real power. Look at Los Angeles. The FHA basically pressured the city to change its zoning, to be more segregated, to make sure developments would be eligible for FHA financing.
So the federal government was using its financial clout to enforce segregation locally?
Precisely. And the FHA's influence lasted for decades, much longer than HOLC's.
Mm-hmm.
It massively shaped post-war suburban development, locking in those patterns.
Okay, so the key point is, this wasn't just happening by itself. Federal agencies were actively driving it.
Deeply embedded policy.
Right. Now, let's jump ahead again. The 50s and 60s, urban renewal, another big federal program.
Yeah, presented as this way to, you know, renew cities, clear slums, modernize, often involved tearing down whole neighborhoods. And it happened alongside building the interstate highway system.
And the examples given, like Southwest D.C. or Lincoln Center in New York.
Often displaced established black communities. And yeah. Cities had big incentives, lots of federal money available to do these kinds of projects.
And typically the communities affected were the ones with less political power to fight back.
That was often the case, yeah. Minority communities frequently bore the brunt. I mean, you had exceptions, like Jane Jacobs fighting Robert Moses in New York, but often the bulldozers won.
So what was driving urban renewal? Just fixing bad housing? Or was reinforcing segregation still part of the picture?
Probably a mix. There was genuinely substandard housing. But the result frequently involved moving people from, say, a poor but maybe integrated neighborhood into other more segregated areas like high-rise public housing.
Yeah, they mentioned that shift from often successful garden-style public housing to the high-rises, which often became big problems later.
Right, and look at New Haven, which was held up as a model city for urban renewal.
What happened there?
Massive destruction of working-class neighborhoods, lots of vacant land, even decades later. And surprise, surprise, it disproportionately displaced Black residents.
It sounds like that desire for nice and tidy zones, just like the earlier zoning effort.
Exactly. A very different vision from the walkable, mixed-use places many people value today.
And the highways themselves, like in Kansas City.
Yeah, building huge interstates often meant deliberately routing them right through existing working-class Black neighborhoods, cutting them up, isolating them first.
Just prioritizing traffic flow over communities.
Seems that way. Especially communities without the clout to redirect things.
Okay, so we've traced decades of these intentional policies stacking up. What are the actual costs? The Dole discussion mentioned a 2017 Urban Institute study on Chicago.
Right, the cost of segregation. They tried to actually put numbers on the economic and social damage caused by segregation there.
How'd they do that?
They looked at the 100 biggest metro areas from 1990 to 2010 and crunched data on segregation levels versus things like income, lifespan, homicide rates, education levels.
And the findings for Chicago were pretty stark.
Yeah. They estimated that if Chicago just moved to the median level of segregation for those 100 cities, not even the best, just average Black per capita income could go up something like 12.4%. That's billions of dollars.
Wow. And other benefits too.
Uh-huh. Higher educational attainment for both Black and white residents.
Mm-hmm.
Lower homicide rates.
And importantly, did they find any upside to segregation for white residents in these metrics?
No. That was a key finding. Segregation didn't seem to benefit white households economically or socially in these ways. It's not a zero-sum game. It drags the whole region down.
That really brings it home. Thinking about our area, Deer Park, LaPorte, Pasadena segregation isn't just an abstract problem. It means real challenges, right? Like getting to jobs.
Absolutely. If jobs are spread out in the suburbs, but affordable housing is concentrated elsewhere, transportation becomes a huge hurdle, a huge inefficiency.
And disparities in schools based on neighborhood.
Exactly. These are real, tangible costs affecting people's lives and the overall health of the Houston region.
So, given this history and these costs, what can be done? Any potential solutions discussed? They mentioned Palisades Park, New Jersey.
Yeah, that was an interesting example. They were late to zoning, apparently didn't adopt it until 1939. And their rules allowed 1- and 2-unit homes pretty much interchangeably.
Light touch density, they called it.
Right. And the result? The town doubled in population over time, but mostly through adding these smaller 2-family houses, not massive apartment blocks. It grew more organically.
And they contrasted that with a neighboring town, Leonia.
Yeah, Leonia had more typical restrictive zoning and ended up with more McMansions, probably less income diversity as a result.
It connects to that idea of highest and best use, right? If zoning only allows giant single-family homes,
then that's what gets built, even if the land is super expensive, because it's the only way to make the numbers work under those rules.
Whereas allowing duplexes, triplexes, fourplexes
could have created millions more homes across the country, often using the same land footprint. It could have really helped with housing supply and affordability.
And we are seeing some cities try to reform zoning now, aren't we? Like Berkeley.
Yeah, places like Berkeley are trying to relax restrictions, allow more multi-unit buildings, maybe even get rid of exclusive single-family zoning.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, you have the whole YMB,
yes,
in my backyard movement, pushing for more density.
And things like ADUs, accessory dwelling units, granny flats.
Exactly. ADUs are becoming more popular. Cities like D.C. are trying incremental upzoning. There's definitely a growing awareness.
It's not easy, is it? There's a lot of pushback.
Oh, yeah. Significant opposition often comes back to those same concerns about property values, neighborhood character, the same anxieties that drove the original policies.
It's deeply ingrained.
Yeah.
So what did the experts recommend policy-wise? Ed Pinto.
Pinto really pushed that light touch density idea, allowing 2-, 3-, 4-unit buildings, ADUs.
Yeah.
But he stressed, you have to be careful. Localities can kill it with other rules.
Like what?
Like excessive parking requirements, minimum square footage rules that make density impossible, super restrictive height limits. He argued for by right permitting make it easier and more predictable to build these things.
Did he have examples where it worked?
He mentioned parts of LA where allowing this kind of density actually did produce more affordable housing. And he framed the goal now as not just racial integration, but socioeconomic integration, too.
And he cautioned against big government programs favoring market approaches.
Yeah, wary of unintended consequences like urban renewal. He liked the Palisades Park example because homeowners themselves had an interest in building duplexes, so there was less resistance.
Makes sense. What about Mark Treskin?
Treskin also supported upzoning, but he added an important point about needing protections against displacement, especially when rezoning specific neighborhoods quickly.
So manage the change carefully.
Right. And he also hit on ADUs, streamlining permits to cut costs, and the huge impact of parking minimums, how much they add to the cost of housing.
Both really focused on those regulatory barriers that inflate costs.
Definitely.
We also had listener questions integrated, like about white flight. How did that connect?
The experts linked it partly to FHA policies in the 60s. Things like offering really risky loans, low down payments, long terms. It inadvertently fueled speculation. It made it easy for speculators to buy properties, maybe scare white owners into selling cheap, then resell, sometimes leading to rapid neighborhood turnover and disinvestment, hurting the folks left behind. There's a book, Cities Destroyed for Cash, that covers this.
So even policies meant to help could backfire and worsen segregation or instability.
It shows how complex this stuff is. Good intentions aren't always enough.
And the final topic was gentrification. That's a really hot issue today.
Yeah, and it's complicated. In theory, it could bring more racial and economic mixing.
But the reality is often
displacement. Long-term residents, often in lower-income communities of color, get priced out or pushed out.
So we need to be really careful not to just repeat old patterns in new ways.
Exactly. Requires constant local conversation, policies that actually benefit everyone, newcomers and existing residents, to make sure development is equitable.
Okay, so wrapping up this deep dive, the big takeaway seems unavoidable. Housing segregation wasn't an accident.
Not at all. It was intentional. Decades of policy, local, state, federal, driven by efforts to separate people by race, often using property values as the justification. Exclusionary zoning, discriminatory lending.
And the costs are real and lasting. That Chicago study showed significant economic and social damage.
Which is why understanding this history is so vital for us here in Deer Park, LaPorte, Pasadena. We need to see how this legacy might still be shaping our housing options, our schools, our opportunities.
And think about what local actions we can take.
Right. Solutions like light touch density, thoughtful zoning reform, they offer potential. We can learn from Palisades Park, but also see the challenges cities face now trying to make these changes.
It's not simple.
Definitely not. But ignoring the history won't help.
So maybe the final thought for listeners is this. As you go about your day in Deer Park or LaPorte or Pasadena, look at the houses, the streets, the neighborhoods.
And ask yourself, how much of what you see is a reflection of these decades of deliberate policy? And what small changes, starting right here locally, could begin to nudge us toward a future that's more inclusive, more equitable for everyone who lives here?
Something to really consider as we try to improve our communities.